Okay, so the book of Zechariah, I'm just going to kind of back up for a second and bring up something. I've mentioned this several times in the course of this study, but before we actually get to chapter 14, I want to have actually dealt with this in just a little bit of detail and give you some more information on it. And that I mentioned it at the very beginning of our study and also had a sermon on it. And that is the fact that during the course of the book of Zechariah, we have over 20 instances where Zechariah says, in that day, over and over again, he talks about a day, and it's called that day. And that day, we need to understand to be the same day all the way through the book of Zechariah. So I went ahead before this evening. I went ahead and made a listing of those. If you'd like to kind of take some notes and jot those down, some of them, as I mentioned in the sermon a month or so ago, about a month and a half ago, I believe it was, I mentioned in the sermon, you may not be sure just exactly when that time that it's referring to when it says that day. You may not be sure when it's referring to, but then there are other times that are actually pretty obvious. For example, you know, we could look at chapter 12 and verses 10 and 11. When we look at chapter 12 and verse 11, it says, in that day there will be great mourning in Jerusalem like the mourning of Hadad-Rimmon in the plain of Megiddo. And we might kind of wonder, well, you know, when is the great mourning that it's referring to? But when we go back to verse 10, it helps us to pinpoint that. Verse 10 says, and I will pour out on the house of David and on the inhabitants of Jerusalem the spirit of grace and of supplication. Of course, instantly in my mind floods the scene of Acts chapter 2, the day of Pentecost. But we go on, the spirit of grace and of supplication, so that they will look on me whom they have pierced, and they will mourn for him as one mourns for an only son, and they will weep bitterly over him like the bitter weeping over the firstborn. And so, what do we have reference to here? Well, the picture is that of the crucifixion of Jesus. He was the one who was pierced, and obviously the great mourning in Jerusalem. You know, we would think of an occasion of everybody just weeping bitterly and openly, but the picture of mourning here really is more that of what is expressed in the Beatitudes in Matthew chapter 5, and that is the mourning that is done there. Blessed are those who mourn, and it's the idea of mourning over sin. And so there was great mourning over their sin. You remember that that crowd was cut to the heart. We back up one chapter, which, Lord willing, we'll get to it tonight. It's only four or five verses away. Here we have the prophecy of the betrayal price in verse 12. And I said to them, if it is good in your sight, give me my wages, but if not, never mind. So they weighed out 30 shekels of silver as my wages. But in verse 11, excuse me, we have that statement, so it was broken on that day. And he's referring to the shepherd's staff that he breaks in their presence. We might wonder, well, when would that day be? Well, it's pinned down by the fact that the prophecy goes on to refer to the betrayal of the Messiah. Really, what we're seeing in this list of over 20 instances, what we're seeing is the Messiah in that day. And over again, what Zechariah does is he chronicles events from that time. And he will briefly pull back to perhaps the time of the writing of Zechariah, or maybe the time directly after it. But he keeps running forward to that day, that day. And so the book of Zechariah, as you can see here, look at how many chapters are included in this and how much material. When you think about the fact that Zechariah only has 14 chapters to it, only 14 chapters, and we see from this permeation of all these passages, all of this permeation of a messianic message, we see that when it comes to the book of Zechariah, if we were to figure the percentage, the number of verses in the book of Zechariah, and the percentage of those verses that are messianic in nature, there would actually be a greater percentage than that of Isaiah. But Isaiah is the prophecy that we call the messianic prophet in prophecy. He's the messianic prophet. Well, and of course, there's good reason for that. I mean, Isaiah, there are 66 chapters there, and there are more messianic prophecies in Isaiah. But pound for pound, Zechariah actually weighs in heavier than the book of Isaiah, but it's not called the messianic. He's not called the messianic prophet. And so I find that very interesting, and it's very compelling, and it's something that we should always keep in mind, we should always remember with regard to the prophecies that are made about Jesus Christ. And so make sure you write these down. I'll leave these up for the bulk of the class period this evening so that you can get them. Now, keep in mind that chapters 9 through 11 are all together. If we go back to chapter 9 and verse 1, the burden of the word of the Lord is against the land of Hadrach with Damascus, so on and so forth. This is a burden, chapters 9 through 11. Some of your translations will call it an oracle. An oracle was a burden. It was a heavy load laid upon the mind of the listener. When we get to chapter 12, we have the next one. The burden of the word of the Lord concerning Israel. So notice that in chapter 9, it's the burden of the word of the Lord against these lands out here. And what he's referring to in that is he's referring to the lands of the Israelites being carried off. They are taken away to these places. Chapter 12, it concerns Israel itself. But it's interesting that chapters 9 through 11, we still have some messianic prophecy going on in that, don't we? Even though it is about those other lands. So, let's drop down into chapter 10 and pull up at verse 8 here. He says, I will whistle for them to gather them together. And of course, when you whistle, other than whistling a tune, typically, why are you whistling? To get someone's attention. To get someone's attention, or something's attention. You know, you may be calling a dog. And you know, frequently people have their dogs trained to where they can just whistle for them and hear and come. And if they don't come, you just shout and they hear your voice and recognize their voice and they come. And the whole idea is you're getting their attention. The word whistle or hiss here in earlier translations doesn't really fully express the picture perhaps that that we might want to get. The word as it's used in the Hebrew is actually a word that was used for luring, like and you know, you might readily think of a fisherman going out and throwing a lure into the water to lure the fish to his hook. You might also think of the woman who goes out and she wants to lure a man. And that's the idea that is expressed here, the idea of luring something or someone. And so he's going to lure them is the idea. He's going to, and so it's not just that, you know, come here. That's not it at all. This is actually the expression of doing something with fond desire to bring about the result. And look at how that works into the language here. I will whistle for them to gather them together, for I have redeemed them. He longs for them and he wants to lure them then. And so he says, and they will be as numerous as they were before. And so I believe when he says as they were before, we think about prior to the captivity, don't we? But it may be that we actually have the picture of as they were before when they were so prolific in the land of Egypt before they came out of bondage, because that's actually going to come into play in his description here. When I scatter them, the word here doesn't mean scatter in the sense of, for example, an army going out. And I think I might better illustrate it with Jonathan. Jonathan and his armor bearer in 1 Samuel chapter 14, I believe it is, they went up to that garrison of the Philistines, you may recall. And they, Jonathan said, you know, let's go up there. If the Lord wants, you know, to defeat them, he's not withholding to save by many or by few. And so the armor bearer says, well, let's go. And so they go, and they end up going up to the garrison of the Philistines, and they're fighting and they're hacking their way through the army. And the observation is made, at the end of that description of the, I think it is of Saul looking and seeing, and the Philistines were melting away. It's the idea of an army being scattered. That's not what this is. That's not that idea at all. The word for that is translated scatter in the New American Standard here, I didn't look to see what it is in other versions, but it refers to the idea of broadcasting with the idea of sowing, as in sowing seed. And so he's not talking about just scattering his people out. He's talking about sowing them. It's something that's very positive. And you can see how that would be the case when he's just said, for I have redeemed them, and they will be as numerous as they were before. And so with that, he says, when I sow them among the peoples, they will remember me in far countries. And the idea of remembering him in far countries, we will quickly get the idea that, well, they had forgotten him, and now he's brought back to their mind. And that's not necessarily the point that's being made here. They with their children will live and come back. And so they will remember me in far countries, not in the sense that they've forgotten him, but in the sense of they're actually acting for the Lord in doing what the Lord would have them to do. I will bring them back from the land of Egypt. We immediately think, okay, they went to the land of Egypt at some point here. But we need to realize that there are figurative expressions being utilized in this text. He speaks of gathering them from Assyria, and we quickly understand that because when they were carried off into captivity, the first dispersion of them into captivity was to where? To Assyria. So we think, oh, well, that makes sense. Well, when did they go into Egypt? And some of the times commentators, they come along and they say, well, you know, they must have fled there from Assyrian captivity. That misses the point. The point that's really being made here is the idea of bondage being taken away from the land that they were in, but not necessarily that it was in the bondage itself and where they actually went, but the concept that Israel would always remember. They had been in Egyptian bondage, and God had called them out. Now they have been in Assyrian captivity, and God has called them out. And he's going to mix these together to bring the whole thing together. So, and just to emphasize that, because, I mean, you think about that and you think, well, that sounds kind of strange. But look at verse 11. he will pass through the sea of distress and strike the waves in the sea. Well, what sea is he talking about here? What sea is in Israel's past? The Red Sea, exactly. He will pass through the sea of distress and strike the waves in the sea. But then, so that all the depths of the Nile will dry up. Well, that didn't happen in Exodus, did it? No, it didn't happen in Exodus. But then he says, and the pride of Assyria will be brought down, and the scepter of Egypt will depart. The whole point here is in mixing together these metaphors of bondage and captivity and the Lord's salvation. And what the Lord had done in the past is he had brought them forth with a mighty outstretched hand. And so he mixes the idea of Egypt and Assyria together with the idea of doing that very same thing again. And that is bringing his people out with a mighty outstretched hand. And I shall strengthen them in the Lord, and in his name they will walk, declares the Lord. And we kind of skipped over the end of verse 10 to get to a point. So he does say there, and I will bring them into the land of Gilead and Lebanon. It's important to know that that's there because it's going to come up in verse 2, verse 1, I'm sorry, of chapter 11. And so until no room can be found for them. So he's very quickly going to get around to the idea of Lebanon here. And that, of course, borders on to Syria here, and was not a friend to Israel at the time of the captivity. So with all of that, we now come to chapter 11, and he says, open your doors, O Lebanon, that a fire may feed on your cedars. Now remember that Lebanon is just to the north. If you pay a lot of attention to the news, you know that, because of more recent events that have taken place between Israel and Lebanon. Lebanon was known for its mighty cedars. That was the riches of that particular land. And it was a large swath of land reaching from Mount Hermon down to the borders of Israel. And a lot of cedars on those mountains, huge, beautiful, aromatic, valuable cedars. And they made a lot of money off of those. You remember that Hiram, king of Tyre, he had made a deal with Solomon for the cedars that would be used in the temple. Hiram, you know, came out, well, smelling like a cedar, I guess you might say. Just absolutely fantastic windfall for him and his country. But he's saying here that fire will feed on the cedars. Wail, O Cyprus, for the cedar has fallen because the glorious trees have been destroyed. Wail, O oaks of Bashan. So now we get to Bashan, which is southeast of Lebanon. Bashan is on the other side of the Jordan River, reaching up next to the Sea of Galilee. And so, wail, O oaks of Bashan, for the impenetrable forest has come down. There is a sound of the shepherd's wail, for their glory is ruined. There is a sound of the young lion's roar, for the pride of the Jordan is ruined. Okay, so all of this northern section here is just going to be positively obliterated. And it's all in the wake of the redemption of God's people. It's all in the wake of saving them. And so what we're seeing in verses 1 through 3 here in chapter 11 is what we might call an introduction. It comes off of chapter 10, which talks about the enemies of the Lord and how Israel will be upheld. And, of course, all of that reaches to the Messiah and the victory that will be had in the Messiah. That's really what this is all about. And so now as we get into chapter 11, we're going to see verses 4 through 14 and then 15 through 17. 4 through 14 is going to talk about the shepherds from one point of view, and then 15 through 17, the shepherds from another point of view. And we're going to look at these shepherds. First, let me say that, you know, identifying the shepherds, as we saw last week, it's not an easy task. A lot of different ideas. There's some difficulty with regard to it. It would, one very good possibility is it is referring to the secular powers. I mentioned this last week, the secular powers that come along. And of course, that eventuates in the Roman Empire, doesn't it? That's who's in power when the Messiah actually comes on the scene. It's also been suggested, and there's possibility that this may be the case, especially when we have it said, verse 8, then I annihilated the three shepherds in 1 month. And we, three shepherds, okay, why three shepherds? Well, evidently there were three in the plural that was earlier in the text, chapters 10 and 11. We just didn't know it, and now we come up with three, but that leaves us with the question, who are the three? So the possibility that's been proposed is that we may be looking at prophet, priest, and king in the land. Prophet, priest, and king. That would make perfect sense from the point of view of priest and king in the land, because that is totally obliterated and everything falls to the Messiah. That could also be argued with regard to Jesus Christ as the perfect prophet, and he would be the only one, but he's not obliterated or destroyed. So maybe it's that the other prophets, the office of prophet, is destroyed and Jesus is set in its place. So it's difficult, but the point, the overarching point in this whole thing is the coming of the Messiah. And the fact that he will reign. So let's look at what is described here. So begin in verse 4 of chapter 11. Thus saith the Lord my God, pasture the flock doomed to slaughter. Those who buy them slay them and go unpunished, and each of those who sell them says, blessed be the Lord, for I have become rich, and their own shepherds have no pity on them. For I shall no longer have pity on the inhabitants of the land, declares the Lord. But behold, I shall cause the men to fall, each into another's power and into the power of his king, and they will strike the land, and I shall not deliver them from their power. So I pastured the flock, doomed to slaughter. That was what he was told to do in verse 4. So I pastured the flock, doomed to slaughter, hence the afflicted of the flock. And I took for myself two staffs. The one I called favor, and the other I called union. So I pastured the flock. Then I annihilated the three shepherds in 1 month, for my soul was impatient with them, and their soul also was weary of me. Then I said, I will not pasture you. What is to die, let it die. What is to be annihilated, let it be annihilated. And let those who are left, eat one another's flesh. And I took my staff, favor, and cut it in pieces to break my covenant, which I had made with all the peoples. Okay, I want to stop right there. We very quickly now are going to go into the prophecy of the betrayal of the Messiah, which of course tells me that we are looking at the days at least leading into the Messiah, if not in that, when we look at these. Now, as you think about what we just read, we have the picture of someone who is doing this. Thus says the Lord my God, pasture the flock doomed to slaughter. And we have to ask the question first, to whom is it being spoken? And our immediate assumption is Zechariah, because he's the one writing the book, correct? Okay, but what if it's not Zechariah? What if someone else is being told to pasture the flock doomed to slaughter? Who might it be? Well, two possibilities readily come to my mind. Generically speaking, perhaps the Lord, or more specifically, the Messiah. Okay? And I kind of like that second possibility there, because everything is leading into the Messiah anyway, as we look at this book. And so now we have the Messiah, and he's being told, pasture the flock doomed to slaughter. Okay, they're doomed to slaughter, and that presents two possibilities in itself. How might they be doomed to slaughter? I'm not asking how they will be slaughtered, but the nature of the slaughter. Might be physical death, right? Or it might be, well, no, kind of on the right track. Spiritual death. Okay, so if he's going to pasture the flock that's doomed to slaughter spiritually, then there's some effect that he will actually have upon them. But of course, we have the outcome in all of this. Those who buy them slay them and go unpunished, and each of those who sell them says, blessed be the Lord, for I have become rich, and their own shepherds have no pity on them. And, you know, I look at the New Testament, and I think the scribes and the Pharisees, whom Jesus called hypocrites, and what they did, they would devour widows' houses. And I mean, they were not shepherds of the people. So that's an interesting possibility right there. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. Okay. The feeding there is the idea of pasturing, the idea of a shepherd feeding the sheep. And so how they are doomed to slaughter is the question that I raise. And a person may be slaughtered physically, and that's the first thing that will come to our mind, right? But then the other possibility is a person who is left to a spiritual slaughter, which is a loss of their spiritual well-being, or in other words, eternally lost. Okay, so the question that I'm raising is there a possibility of this being the Messiah, and he's being told to pasture those who are doomed to slaughter spiritually? How are they doomed to slaughter spiritually? Because without the Messiah, there is no hope. There's nothing anyone can do. And he's actually the only one who can pasture them. Okay? Okay, so in verse 6, for I shall no longer have pity on the inhabitants of the land, declares the Lord. I shall cause the men to fall, each into another's power, into the power of his king, and they will strike the land. And I shall not deliver them from their power. And so the possibility here is that we are looking at Israel at the time of the Messiah, under Roman domination. And of course, just looking at it very briefly, what eventually happens to Jerusalem? It's destroyed. And it's destroyed by whom? The Romans. The Romans come in AD 70 and they destroy the city. And so, you know, I think that's a very compelling and interesting possibility in view of the fact that we are looking at this time frame. Verse 7, so I pastured the flock doomed to slaughter, hence the afflicted of the flock. And I took for myself two staffs, the one I called favor. And of course, favor is the idea of grace in my mind. But here it's actually the pleasantness, the mildness, the meekness, like of a shepherd is the idea that's being presented. And the other I call union, a word that it actually comes from a Hebrew word that refers to two cords that are braided together. In other words, they are united. So it's frequently used of being united or union. So I pastured the flock. Then I annihilated the three shepherds in 1 month, for my soul was impatient with them, and their soul also was weary of me. Verse 8 describes what Jesus did. There's no doubt about that. He destroyed the offices of prophet, priest, and king in Israel so that he might, under the new covenant, be our prophet, priest, and king. And so that, to me, that's a very compelling possibility for the text there. Then I said, I will not pasture you. What is to die, let it die. What is to be annihilated, let it be annihilated. Let those who are left eat one another's flesh. And I took my staff favor, cut it in pieces to break my covenant, which I had made with all the peoples. All the peoples, if you were an Israelite reading this, what would you think he meant by all the people? See, we immediately think, well, all the people, the Assyrians, the Egyptians, the, you know, Syrians, all of the people. But for the Israelites, it's a prophecy dealing with them. And so they're thinking, okay, well, he's broken the covenant with Israel. Well, did Jesus do that? He fulfilled the Old Testament, but in so doing, he did what? Yeah, but before he could establish the new one, he had to break the other one in half. He had to cut it off. And so we have the statement here, to break my covenant, which I had made. And the idea here is that of annulling something. And that's what he did. He annulled the Old Testament law so that he might put the New Testament law, into place. So it was broken on that day. And I believe that that coincides with verse 8. With annihilating the three shepherds in 1 month. I put them all together. And so it was broken on that day, and thus the afflicted of the flock who were watching me realized that it was the word of the Lord. And then immediately, in verse 12, he goes into the prophecy with regard to the betrayal price. And I said to them, if it is good in your sight, give me my wages. But if not, never mind. So they weighed out 30 shekels of silver as my wages. By the way, 30 shekels of silver, does anybody know what that bought in that day? What was that the price of under the law of Moses? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Your Savior, Jesus Christ, was valued at the price of a slave. That was the price that was weighed out to Judas Iscariot for Jesus. And so they weighed out 30 shekels of silver. And I have trouble believing that that was just a coincidence. Because after all, the chief priests and the elders who weighed that money out, were they friends of Jesus? How did they feel about Jesus? Listen, they would have stuck it to him any and every way they possibly could have. And this does it right here. He had the price of a slave put on him. So they weighed out the 30 pieces of silver. And so the Lord said to me, throw it to the potter, that magnificent price. And you can see the touch of sarcasm there, if you want to call it just a touch. That magnificent price at which I was valued by them. So I took the 30 pieces of silver and threw them to the potter in the house of the Lord. Now, did the house of the Lord have a resident potter that made pottery? No. No. There was no potter in the house of the Lord. No potter. And yet, when he makes the prophecy here, he's commanded to throw it to the potter. Okay, so he's going to throw it to a potter. But he understands it to be the potter in the house of the Lord, which there is no potter in the house of the Lord. And so from this point right here, we have a prophecy that seems to have no hope of ever being fulfilled. Because when the price is weighed out and it's thrown into the house of the Lord, there's no potter. And yet when we come to the New Testament, we find out what the true significance was. And what was that? Yeah, Judas Iscariot. What about the potter? Yes, the potter's field. And so they take the price. And by the way, who takes the price and pays for the potter's field? Was it the disciples? Was it Joseph of Arimathea? Yeah, so as the chief priests and the elders, the enemies of the cause of truth, the enemies of Jesus, they're going to fulfill the prophecy and they're going to buy a field with it. Well, they buy the potter's field. I mean, who would have figured? Well, God would have. Because God knew exactly what was going to happen. So, do you see why this is one of my favorite prophecies in the Old Testament? I mean, hope against hope that this prophecy would ever be fulfilled. I mean, it is slim to none. And yet it is fulfilled perfectly when Judas throws that magnificent price into the house of the Lord, and the chief priests and the elders are the ones who buy the potter's field. And that, of course, is the very place where Judas ends up. You know, in all irony. Yes? Oh, okay. The potter's field, when a potter, and, you know, we're not real familiar with the process that goes on with regard to pottery, but when pottery is made, I think we typically think that the potter makes it on the wheel, they set it out, it dries, and everything's great, okay? And if they place it in a kiln, you know, everything's great. The problem is it's not always great. Frequently, you end up with pottery that just in the drying process cracks. We think, oh, well, we can fix it. No, they didn't fix it. They threw it out. And you end up with shards of pottery everywhere. And, well, you don't just throw it anywhere. You throw it all in the same place. And this was, it would seem obvious, that it was a field that belonged to a potter who threw the pottery out, and it was just... And, of course, you can imagine that makes it kind of useless for much of anything else. I mean, you don't put your animals out there to feed. You don't sow seed there. It becomes the potter's field. And so it's useless, really, is what it is. And so the money was thrown to buy a useless field is really what it ends up being. Yes, he hung himself. You'll remember he hung himself. I don't remember if the text actually says he hung himself there, but it's where, as I recall, it's where he was actually buried. Yeah. A little bit of irony there is...
in Acts chapter 1, Peter makes the point that he bought that field with the wages of his iniquity. And so that was an interesting way for Peter to look at that. Okay, good questions. Anything else? No? That second bell hadn't rung, has it? Just the first. Okay. Okay, so we have the prophecy in verse 14, that I cut my second half, union, in pieces to break the brotherhood between Judah and Israel. And so Judah and Israel then, of course, at the time of the Messiah, there is no need for that brotherhood anymore. That's an interesting aspect of this as well. You would think that that would be the yearning, that all of this come together and we become the great one nation again. And really that was never the intention of God, and that brotherhood is now gone. Okay, so, well, just three verses left in the chapter, and I'm not in any way going to be able to do that. Lord willing, I'm going to pick up then at verse 15. Any questions? Any questions? I'll give John a few extra minutes here.
The second bell rang.
Oh, it did? Well, you didn't say anything.
It just rang.
Oh, it did? Okay. Okay. Okay, chapter 11 and verse 15 next week, Lord willing.